Osho, Sufis, the People of the Path, Volume 2, Talks on Sufism, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 15.
Bhagwan, the Sufi state sage Abdul Alim of Fez refused to teach, but from time to time would advise people about the way to proceed on the path. One day a disciple, who was both incapable of learning and regularly driven abnormal by attending mystical ceremonies, visited him. He asked, "How can I best profit from the teachings of the sages?" The Sufi said, "I am happy to be able to tell you that I have an infallible method which corresponds to your capacity." "And what is that, if I am allowed to hear it?" "Simply stop up your ears and think about radishes. Before, during, or after the lectures and exercises, instead of attending any of them."
Man is a quest, not a question, but a quest. A question can be solved intellectually, but the quest has to be solved existentially. It is not that we are seeking some answers for some questions. It is that we are seeking some answer for our being. It is a quest because questions are about others. The quest is about oneself. Man is seeking himself. He knows he is, but he also knows that he does not know who he is. Hence, from the very birth, a great inquiry starts rising in the innermost core of man. We can repress that inquiry. We can divert that inquiry. We can change that inquiry for substitute inquiries, but we cannot kill it. There is no way to kill it because it is intrinsic to human nature. It is intrinsic to consciousness to know what it is. It comes in its very nature. And unless it is resolved, man remains searching. Of course, there are 999 ways to go wrong, and there is only one way to go right. So the search is full of hazards. It is not simple. It is very complex. And it is very rare that a man reaches. But unless you reach, you will continue in agony, in turmoil. You will remain a cry in the wilderness. You will not know what joy is. Not knowing yourself how you can be joyous. And you will not know what benediction is. Not knowing yourself, there is no benediction. You will hear words like contentment, blissfulness, but they will remain birds. They won't have any content for you. the content has to be supplied by your experience. They will remain empty words. They will create much noise around you, but they will not mean anything. Search is intrinsic to human nature. But then the problem arises. There are many ways to go wrong. How to find the right path? This small parable is of immense significance. Each word of it has to be understood. Carlyle has said, "The misfortune of man has its source in his greatness, for there is something infinite in him, and he cannot succeed in burying himself completely in the finite. There is something in man which is higher than man, bigger than man, and there is no way to bury it somewhere into the finite. You can seek money and power, but each time you will succeed, you will find that you have failed. Each time you will succeed, the success will bring just nothing but an awareness of the failure. Money is there, but you are as dissatisfied as ever, or even more. Power is there, and you are as impotent as ever. Nothing makes man aware more powerless than power. Nothing makes man more aware of inner poverty than riches. Because of the contrast, one can see riches are outside and inside I am a beggar, still desiring and asking and hankering and searching. From one side, this seems to be a misfortune, the misery of man. From another side, it is his greatness. Carlyle is right when he says the misfortune of man has its source in his greatness. What is this greatness? This greatness is his capacity to surpass himself, to go beyond himself, to make a ladder of his life, to jump out of himself. Unless that jump has happened, you live in a wasteland. Nothing will ever bloom there. You can make all the efforts possible, but the desert will remain desert. You will not come across any flowers. Those flowers start happening only when you have started reaching somewhere close to truth. That is the quest. The quest is that man longs to become God. The quest is that man wants to become truth. Anal haq. Man wants to feel it, that I am truth. Nothing less than that will ever satisfy you. This parable. The Sufi sage Abdul Alim of Fez refused to teach, but from time to time would advise people about the way to proceed on the path. Go slowly and meditatively. The first thing to be understood is the meaning of the word sage. Sufis make a great distinction between the word saint and the word sage. And there is a great distinction. They are not synonymous. Not withstanding what your dictionaries say. They are not synonymous. Man ordinarily can have two kinds of characters. One is the negative character, the character of the criminal, the antisocial, the character of the rebellious. Another is the positive character, the character of the conventional, orthodox, respectable. The criminal will be punished, will be thrown in the prison if caught. The society will try to destroy him because he is a danger to the society. He is disobedient. He is trying to assert himself, and the society does not like that. The society exists by destroying individuals. The society can exist only by destroying individuals. The society has more power if there are no individuals around. If there are individuals, then the power is less and less and less. If the whole society consists of individuals, then there will be no power in the authority. There will be no power to the priest or the politician. So the antisocial, the immoral, the individual who wants to have his own morality, who wants to do his own thing, society tries to crush him, uproot him, destroy him. Society is very murderous about the negative. And naturally, on the other hand, society respects the positive. If you follow the society, society honors you. So the one, the negative character, becomes criminal, and the other, the positive character, becomes a respected gentleman. If the criminal goes on moving to the logical extreme, then he will become the devil. And if the gentleman goes on moving to the logical extreme, he will become the saint. The saint is one who is for the society, hence the society is for him. And the evil character is one who is not for the society, is only for himself. The society is naturally against him. But there is one thing which is common in both, that they are half. This has to be understood. This is one of the most important Sufi ideas. Both are half, partial. The saint has only the positive and is missing the negative. That's why you will find your sins very boring. You will find your sins very flat, dull. You will find to live with your sins, even for 24 hours, a great ordeal. The saint will not have any joy. He will be sad. He will never do anything wrong. He will be always good. But he will not have any song to sing. He will not have any uniqueness about him. He will be just a type, a stereotype. He will not have any unique taste of his own. He will be conformist. He will be almost dead, because the positive is bound to be dead. Unless the negative goes on playing with it, there is no joy. Life is a warp and woof between the positive and the negative. You cannot make saints the whole. Hence, Sufis will not say that the saint is holy, because he is not whole. He is half. His half part, the negative part, has been repressed, denied. All connections have been cut from the negative part. The negative is thrown into the unconscious, Benjian. The saint has tried in every way not to be even aware of it, that it exists. But it exists. There is no way to drop it. The only way to go beyond it is to absorb it, not to drop it. Let me repeat. The only way to go beyond it is to absorb it. But that needs great intelligence. That needs great understanding, wisdom, meditativeness, that you can transform the poison into elixir. The negative is poisonous, but the poison can become medicinal in the right hands. The saint is a little stupid. You will find saints stupid, mediocre. They were not really intelligent people, otherwise they would have transformed their negative. They would have transformed all that is dangerous into a beautiful flowering. The saint will carry the negative in the unconscious. So if you look from a window in the mind of the saint while he is asleep, you will be surprised. He is doing things which you cannot even think about him. In dreams, the saint will become the negative. Shift will be there. A total shift from the positive to the negative. Because the negative also needs a little play, a little activity. So the dreams of the saints you will find are very criminal. That's why saints are very much afraid to sleep. They go on reducing their sleep. Because it is the only thing where they are without any control. The moment they fall asleep, the control is lost. The conscious goes to sleep and the unconscious takes possession. And the unconscious is the negative. And they are very much afraid because in the unconscious they are having repressed sexuality, murderous instincts, anger, rage, hatred, all kinds of scorpions and snakes and poisonous beings. They all start bubbling up, surfacing. Saints are very much troubled by their sleep. Because sleep brings one fact home and brings it very clearly, that the unconscious or the negative has not been destroyed, it is still there. Saints have great nightmares. The criminals, the antisocial, the rebellious, the negative personality is also half. These are the negative people who become great politicians, sometimes great revolutionaries, and release on the world great negative poison. And Adolf Hitler, or Joseph Stalin, or Benito Mussolini, or Mao Zedong, these are the negative type people. Just the opposite of the saint, but in one way, almost the same. As half as the saint is. The difference is only one. What the saint has made the unconscious, they have made their conscious. And what they have made their conscious, the saint has made their unconscious. Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler are not different from Mahatma Gandhi. The only difference is that what is repressed in Mahatma Gandhi is expressed in Adolf Hitler. And what is expressed in Adolf Hitler is repressed in Mahatma Gandhi. Mahatma Gandhi goes on repressing the negative, Adolf Hitler goes on expressing the negative. Adolf Hitler and Mahatma Gandhi are exactly the same type of people. Just one is standing on his head doing a Sirsasana, head stand. But the type is exactly the same. There is not any difference. And you will be surprised to know that these great criminals have beautiful dreams, far beautiful than the saints can ever have. Because their repressed positivity comes in their dreams. In their dreams they become great saints. They do great good things to humanity. These are the two ordinary types of people, the saint and the sinner. They go together. In a world where are no more sinners, there will be no more saints. In a world where are no more saints, there will be no more sinners. They are partners in the same business. They exist together. They help each other. Without the one, the other cannot even exist, cannot survive. The sinner gives the definition to the saint, and the saint gives the definition to the sinner. The sage is a totally different kind of consciousness. It is a whole. It is not a choice. It is neither positive nor negative. It has absorbed both. It is total acceptance. Whatsoever is given by God has to be transformed into one unity. Man has not to choose, but to accept. And remember, by acceptance I don't mean tolerance. When you tolerate something, you have not really accepted it. You say, what can be done? It is there, so okay. I will tolerate it. If it cannot be dropped, if it cannot be destroyed, then I will have to tolerate. Remember, acceptance is not just tolerance. Acceptance is joyful welcome. Whatsoever God has given must have some meaning. I may not be able to see right now the meaning of it. I will have to search for it. But this is a tacit understanding that whatsoever is given must have some meaning, otherwise it would not have been given in the first place. With this understanding, a sage is born. A sage is a holy man because a sage is whole. He does not deny his sexuality. He does not deny his anger. He does not deny anything at all. He accepts everything with deep understanding, gratitude, welcome. And in that very understanding, in that very welcoming attitude, things start changing. A great alchemical change happens. And this is a miracle that happens in a sage. Anger becomes compassion. Anger plus understanding is equal to compassion. Sex plus meditation is equal to samadhi. There is a path which is carrying all seeds of meditation. And there is another part which is carrying all seeds of sexuality. The sinner denies the meditative part and accepts the sexual part. The saint denies the sexual part and accepts the meditative part, but both remain lopsided. The sage accepts both, brings them together. Meditativeness and sexuality. And what is a great miracle happening in himself? The greatest. As meditativeness and sexuality come close, suddenly there is a change. They become one flame. And that one flame has a totally new quality. Just like as when hydrogen and oxygen meet, you have water. Now this is a miracle. Miracle in the sense, because the oxygen has not the qualities of water. Neither hydrogen has the qualities of water. When hydrogen and oxygen come close, get into a loving embrace, become one unity, suddenly a new quality arises into existence, which was not in either of the components. You can drink as much oxygen as you want, but your thirst will not go. And you can drink as much oxygen as you want, and your thirst will not go. And water is nothing but H2O. Then water has something which is not contained in the past. Something new has happened. The parts have disappeared into something new. A higher synthesis has been arrived. That's what I mean by organic transformation. Whenever two things meet, if there is a real meeting, a third thing is born. When a man and woman love and meet, a child is born. Now the child will not have the qualities of the father and will not have the qualities of the mother. The child will have his own qualities. The child will be an unique individual. You cannot reduce the child just to the qualities of the parents. You cannot say this quality comes from the parent, this from this parent, and the child is just a sum total of it. No. If the child is just a sum total of the parents, then there is no soul. The child must be something more than the sum total of the parents. Then only there is soul. Water is something more than the sum total of H2O. When two opposites meet, only then this organic transformation happens. Man and woman meet, then a child is born. A child cannot be born by meeting a man with another man or a woman with another woman. Similars cannot create, only opposites. Now meditativeness and love are opposites. Meditativeness needs aloneness. Love needs the other. Sexuality and meditation are opposites. Sexuality is a desire, continuous desire, unfulfilled, remains unfulfilled. And meditation is desirelessness. These are opposites. When they meet, suddenly there is a flare-up. Something happens which was not contained in either. The saint is just meditative. He is carrying hydrogen or oxygen. The sinner is just sexual. He is carrying another part. When the saint and the sinner meet in you, the sage is born. When the polarities meet in you, in deep embrace, are lost into each other, lose all definitions, merge, become one, the sage is born in you. Sage is the rarest flowering in existence. The saint is a far away echo of it. As far away as the sinner. So Sufis say, the sage is not a saint. You can find many saints, that is very easy. saints are a social phenomenon. But to find a sage is difficult. Because the sage is as individual as the criminal and as cosmic as the saint. He is both together. In the sage, God and devil meet and lose all their identities. That is the highest meeting, and there is no higher than that. This moment of meeting within you of the sinner and the saint, of the negative and the positive, is the moment of samadhi. The sage is no mind. The sinner is negative mind, the saint is positive mind, the sage is no mind. The sinner lives in constant duality, he has to fight with his saint. Remember it. The sinner has continuously to fight with his saint, because the saint is there. The sinner is going to kill somebody and the saint says, don't do this, this is not right. He has to fight. His fight is as arduous as the fight of the saint. The saint has to fight the sinner. Somebody insults him and a great desire to kill him arises, and he has to fight with that desire. He cannot do it. He is a saint. He is a holy man. He is a religious man, this and that. Both go on fighting. They have to, because they live in the duality. And the repressed part goes on taking revenge. It waits for right moments to assert itself. In the sage, there is silence. There is no duality. The sage becomes a silent shrine. There is no more any conflict, any antagonism. There is no more any war going in him. There is utter peace. That's what Sufis call Islam. There is utter peace, silence. Those warring elements have disappeared into unity. The marriage has happened. The Sufi sage, Abdul Alim, when the parable sage, it means an enlightened person. One who has come home. The Sufi sage Abdul Alim of Fej refused to teach, but from time to time would advise people about the way to proceed on the path. Why he should refuse to teach? A sage always refuses to teach. The reason? Because truth cannot be taught. The sage is never a teacher. He is a master, but he is never a teacher. First, the truth cannot be taught. It can only be caught. You can catch it like an infection from the master. You can allow yourself to be close to him, and one day you can catch. But it cannot be taught. It is not a kind of information that can be delivered to you. It is an existential experience. You can partake of it, but it cannot be given to you. Nobody can give you truth. And I'm not saying he cannot give you because he has not. No. Even if he has, he cannot give it. It is not a thing. And it is not information. It is not knowledge. It is a lived experience. You will have to live in the Master, with the Master. It will happen. In a very mysterious way it happens. Strange are the ways of God. Only untruth can be delivered. Truth cannot be delivered. So the sage is never a teacher. This is the difference between a teacher and a master. He is available to give you. But the giving is very subtle. The giving is very esoteric. It is very occult. It is very hidden. It cannot be given as scientific knowledge is given to you. You cannot make any education out of it. You cannot put it in words, theories, clear-cut principles. It is so vast. The moment you put it into any principle, you can immediately see something has disappeared from it. It is no more alive. Principles are like photographs. A bird on the wing is one thing. You take a photograph. Now the photograph shows the bird on the wing. But it is just a photograph. The bird is no more flying. Everything has stopped. It is not alive. I have heard one beautiful woman told Pablo Picasso the other day, she said, "I saw one of your self-portraits. It was beautiful." The woman was a bore, and Picasso was fed up with her. And she went on and on, and she said, "It was really beautiful, and you have done such a beautiful job, and I loved the painting so much that I kissed it." Picasso suddenly became alive, and he said, "And then what happened? Did the painting kiss you?" The lady said, "What are you talking about? How the painting can kiss me?" Then Picasso said, "Then it was not me." The bird on the wing is alive. The flower on the tree is alive. My hand in a gesture is a bird on the wing. It is alive. You can have a photograph, but something very essential will be missing from it. It will be only the outline of the hands. The soul will be missing out of it. So it happens with truth. Truth is aliveness. It is eternal life. The moment you put it into words, then you have photographs. So a sage cannot teach the truth. He can only show you the way. Where you can go and see yourself the bird on the wing. He cannot teach you principles. He can only indicate the way. He cannot inform you about truth. He can only inform you about the methods that can clean your heart, that can clarify your mind, that can subdue your inner turmoil, that can help you to stop your constant inner talk, so that you are in a silent state of mind and you can see truth, because truth is all around. Just the silence of the mind is needed. The master can not teach you, but he can inspire you. The master cannot teach you, but he can invoke you. The master cannot teach you, but he can invite you. A master is a finger pointing to the moon. A master is not a teacher. And second thing, teaching is always general. The teaching is always theoretical. The teaching is like the menu. You cannot eat it. And you cannot be nourished by it. The teaching is like a pornographic photograph. It is not the real woman or the real man. You cannot love it. You cannot be loved by it. A master, a sage, can advise you, but he cannot teach you. What is the difference? Advice is always personal. It is never general. Advice is from person to person, heart to heart. Advice is always practical, never theoretical. Advice is always experimental, never philosophical. Advice is like food, and teaching is like menu. Advice is like a real man or a real woman, and teaching is just pornographical. The story says the Sufi sage Abdul Alim of Fej refused to teach, but from time to time would advise people about the way to proceed on the path. From time to time, he will advise people. Only when he will find somebody is ready. Only when he will find that there is a burning desire. Only when he will see that there is a quest, not only curiosity. Only when he will see that there is a sincere desire to devote oneself, to sacrifice oneself for the truth. Only when he will see that, yes, here is a gambler who can gamble, not a businessman who will calculate each step. Truth is for gamblers, because it is for those who can risk. It is not for business people. So only when he will find that somebody is really in need, his advice will be available. That's why masters have always moved away from the masses. They create 1001 ways to stop the masses coming to them. They exist only for the few, for those who are really in search. And they create devices so they become invisible to the masses. For example, you can see I am here, but I am invisible to Pune people. It is deliberately done. I am here only for those people who need advice, who are really searching on their own. Even if no advice is going to come, they will go on searching. They will go on risking their life in the search. If advice is available, then many pitfalls can be avoided. This is the difference between teaching and advice. Whatsoever I say to you is not a teaching. It is only advice. It is a provocation. It is a seduction, not a teaching. It is a persuasion, but not a teaching. It is encouragement, but not a teaching. It is to give you courage, zest, gusto, so that you can go on with more fervor, with more verve, with more energy, so that you can be more certain that there is a hope. All that I say to you is just to create hope in you, because the path is dark. And there are 1001 pitfalls. And the path goes on branching in many wrong paths. A master is needed to keep you on the right track. One day, a disciple who was both incapable of learning and regularly driven abnormal by attending mystical ceremonies visited him. He asked few things about this disciple. First, he is not a disciple. He thinks he is a disciple. He is at the most a student. Just the same difference as there is between a teacher and a master, so is there between a student and a disciple. A student is there to collect some information. A student is there to become more knowledgeable. A student is there who wants to know more, but without risking anything. The student is one who is not ready to pay with any price. He wants to remain as he is. Just he wants to accumulate more knowledge. He wants to become more intellectual. He wants to become a scholar. He wants to become a pundit, a doctor, but he is not interested in transforming himself. He wants to hold truth in his hands, but he is not ready to dissolve himself into truth. He wants to possess truth, but he does not want to be possessed by truth. A disciple is one who wants to be possessed by truth. A disciple cannot think that I should possess truth, how I can possess truth. In fact, the I is the only barrier towards truth. How can I possess truth? And truth is vast. Truth is infinite. How it can be possessed in such a small head? It is not possible. You cannot possess the ocean in your fist, but you can drown yourself in the ocean and disappear. That's how a disciple is ready to drown himself and to disappear. Even if the price is by his life, he is ready. There is something more valuable than life, then you become a disciple, otherwise not. If you can sacrifice your life for something, then you are a disciple. Otherwise you are a student, greedy, and you want to have some information so that you can use in your life. You can succeed in a better way. Many people come to me. Even though I have created so many barriers, sometimes, somehow, they sneak in. And they ask me questions which should not be asked. They ask me, if we meditate, what benefit will be there in worldly ways? Will it make us more healthy, more successful? Will it help us to succeed in the world? Or somebody comes and asks, will it help us to make my memory more strong, my remembrance? Will it help my mind to become more intelligent? They are not interested in meditation as such. They are interested in something else. Now they think if meditation can be exploited for that good. They are students. A disciple is one who has understood one thing, that I don't know who am I. And that is the most and the fundamental thing to know first. Anything else is secondary. I must know who am I. Only then life can have any meaning, otherwise it can't have any meaning. I can go on working and accumulating things, money, prestige, but how that is going to satisfy me? Because I don't know even who am I. I must first have an absolute feel of my being. Only then I can be on the right track. Everybody wants to have bliss. But how can you have bliss if you are not even aware who you are? One has to be absolutely aware of one's nature. Only then bliss is possible. Otherwise, you will go on searching for something which may not be at all helpful to your bliss. And you may go on missing something which was just by the corner, but was absolutely meant for your bliss. But how can you judge? You don't know yourself. You are not aware of your nature. A disciple has only one desire, to know himself, and he is ready to do whatsoever is needed for it to be done. He is unconditionally ready to pay any price. One day a disciple who was both incapable of learning and regularly driven abnormal by attending mystical ceremonies visited him. Now he is not a disciple. He thinks he is a disciple. He may be going to many people, so he thinks he is a disciple. But he is not even capable of learning. The word disciple comes from a root which means capacity to learn. And he is not capable of learning. What prevents people from learning? What makes people incapable? Few things. One, the capacity to learn needs a state of not knowing. You must be innocent like a child, only then you can learn. If you already know, you cannot learn. You must know that you don't know. You must not carry the ego of knowledge that I know. The second thing, a great receptivity is needed, because you will have to absorb. Openness is needed. You cannot remain closed. You cannot remain closed with your old prejudices, ideas, concepts, ideologies. Intelligence is needed. And when I say intelligence, always remember, I never mean intellectuality. Intellectuality is a substitute for intelligence. People who pretend to be intelligent are intellectuals. A real man of intelligence is not intellectual at all. He is existential. He knows it perfectly well that intellect is uncreative. It cannot create anything. At the most, it is a good survival device, but uncreative. All that is created by something else. That is intelligence. Call it intuitiveness. But that is something else. It has nothing to do with your intellect. In a university, your intellect is trained. You are taught how to argue, how to prove, how to discuss, how to debate. You are taught logic, and through logic, intellect arises. Now, logic is in itself very illogical, because it does not cover the whole life. It is very partial. Life is more than logic. It is paradoxical. So once you have got very much fixed into your logic, you will start losing track of life. You will become more and more of an intellectual and less intelligent. An intelligent person accepts logic, accepts illogic too. An intelligent person always accepts the polarity. He never chooses. He does not say, I will choose the negative, or I will choose the positive, or I will choose this and I will deny that. Intelligence accepts all. Intelligence has no choice. That's why Krishnamurti goes on defining intelligence as choiceless awareness. And sometimes you can find it You can find a non-intellectual person who is absolutely uneducated, maybe a primitive living in a village, but of immense intelligence. You can see in his eyes intelligence, radiance. You can see in his acts intelligence. And you can see a university professor behaving very unintelligently and maybe a great intellectual. Then intelligence means awareness. Intelligence means a kind of presence. Instantaneous presence, immediate presence. It happens every day here. I can go on looking at you. Whenever I see some intellectual, I can immediately feel that he is closed in a kind of wall, transparent wall. He listens and yet he does not listen. Because he is constantly thinking whether it is right or not. Constantly thinking whether it agrees with me or not. Constantly thinking yes, no, choosing. And in that very choosing he is losing. He is missing the whole point. An intelligent person listens attentively with no idea. There is no need to decide right now. He is immediately with me. It does not mean that he agrees with me. It does not mean that he is agreeing or disagreeing, no. He is simply listening. What is the point of agreeing and disagreeing? That can be done later on. And there is a miracle. If you can listen totally attentively, in that very listening you will know what is truth and what is not truth. There will be no need to think about it. The very silent quality of listening will make you aware what is truth. Truth has its own revelation. When it is there, you start feeling it is there. When it is not there, 1001 arguments cannot prove that it is there. Truth has its own solid presence. You have to be just available to it. So the capacity to learn means intelligence, innocence, childlike readiness to go into the unknown, to explore, to be always in a kind of wonder, feeling the mystery of life. This is the capacity to learn that makes a disciple, and against it is the incapacity, knowledgeability, intellectuality, or call it stupidity, which means the same. They are synonymous. Intellectuality or stupidity. Closedness. Prejudiced mind. Full of junk. Full of the past. No space for the new. A disciple is a womb ready to receive the truth, ready to receive the master, ready to receive his energy. And remember, with the master it is always a transfer of energy. Unseen by you, untouched by you, a constant shower is happening of energy. If you are receptive, you will be utterly satisfied by it. Your thirst will disappear. But if you are only listening to the words and collecting the words and proving, disproving, agreeing, disagreeing, then you are not here. You are not present. You are almost absent, physically here, but not psychologically here, not spiritually at all. One day a disciple who was both incapable of learning and regularly driven abnormal by attending mystical ceremonies, visited him. Now this too has to be understood. This matter of mystical experiences is a very delicate one. First, all over the world, down the ages, mystical ceremonies have existed. Now, a mystical ceremony is a ritual in which you start by pretending, and later on, by and by, you are hypnotized by your own pretension. Slowly, slowly, the pretension becomes a kind of auto-hypnosis. For example, you participate in a mystical ceremony. It will be a ritual in the beginning. Ritual can be of many kinds. Every religion has its own. For example, if you participate in a mystical ceremony which is based on the idea of kundalini energy, serpent powers. So first you read about what kundalini is, naturally. You have to become acquainted what kundalini is. So you understand the physiology of the kundalini. You read Gopi Krishna and people like that. And you know that there are these many centers and this is the passage from where the energy rises in the spine and it goes moving upwards and where it reaches and what happens. And then finally it reaches in the head and then your whole body is shaken, trembling, and there is great light and there is great joy, and these things you read. Naturally, a great greed arises in you to have these experiences. And suddenly you see something is being missed by you, others are having great experiences, and you are missing. That creates a kind of jealousy, competition, greed, desire, longing. Just few years before, the Pope of the Vatican announced that there are 163 kind of sins. And immediately thousands of letters reached to the Vatican that please sir give us the whole list, because many felt that many they are missing. 163 kind of sins. You will also wonder what you are missing. Maybe you are doing 2, 3, 4, 5, at the most 7. But 163? People are really having time, good time. Many inquiries reach that we would like to know what are these 163 sins. People become intrigued when they see that somebody is having something. A great desire, a great wish arises. So first you read about kundalini, you become suffused with the knowledge of the centers, their colors, their mantras, their places in the physical body. You visualize them, then you participate in a ceremony. In the ceremony you see people whose kundalini is rising. Somebody is getting very ecstatic and you feel very, very deep depressed that you have never seen such beauty, such experiences. You also sit there. You also visualize people are swaying, people are enjoying. Tears are flowing, their faces aglow. Sooner or later, you get into the ritual. You also start swaying. Man is very imitative. The spiritual seeker has to be very much alert about imitativeness. First you start swaying and you know that you are just doing it yourself. Sooner or later you get into it. Your wish becomes a kind of wish fulfillment. You auto-hypnotize yourself, and there are many people. It is great hypnosis all around you. And you start seeing light inside. Mind is very imaginative. It can imagine anything. And remember, I am not saying Kundalini is wrong. And remember, I am not saying that light is not seen. And I am not saying that there are no mystical experiences. No, not in the least. I am not saying that. But out of 100 people, 99 go on creating it by imagination. That is not true. The real experience has nothing to do with your imagination. The real experience has nothing to do with your knowledge about Kundalini. The real experience has nothing to do with the textbooks about Kundalini. And the real experience is always unique. It never happens the same to two persons. So those seven chakras are there. But they are not at the same places in everyone. When you see a chart of Kundalini, it is just a generalized chart. It is almost like here we are, 1,000 persons. And if somebody asks the average height comes somewhere 5 inches. 5 feet are 5 feet, 5.5 inches. That is average height. Now you can go on searching for the average man and you will not find. Somebody will be 5'6", somebody will be 5'4", somebody will be 5'7". There will be all kinds of people. The average is just a generalized form. Exactly like that it happens. There are seven chakras, but they don't exist in the same places to all peoples. And there are experiences, but they never happen the same to two persons. They happen very, very differently. So there is no need to know the physiology of the Kundalini, and there is no need to know the chakras, and there is no need to know what happens finally. Because if you know it, you will start hypnotizing yourself. And by, you will start getting into the ritual. And you will create a kind of dream around you. And when there are many people doing the same, you tend to fall into the crowd mind. You start swaying with the crowd. Have you watched it sometimes? How you fall into the crowd and become one with it? A crowd is going, a crowd of Hindus to burn a mosque, or a crowd of Mohammedans to destroy a temple. You are a Hindu and you go into the Hindu crowd. You were not really thinking to burn the mosque. You have never thought before. You are not that kind of man. Not that destructive, not that violent, aggressive. You are a nice person. You have never burnt anything, anybody. And when you had joined the crowd, you were not really thinking to anything. You were just curious where this crowd is going. You were just intrigued what is going to happen. You were just going there as a kind of entertainment, with no idea in particular to do anything. Then, by and by, you get excited by the crowd, those people rushing around you from all sides, and with such great energy and shouting and a slogan and protesting their energy functions on you. Your energy starts being aroused. By and by you see that you are getting excited. The whole excitement around you. How can you be aloof? You become excited. And by the time you reach the mosque or the temple, and when people start burning, suddenly you find yourself doing things you had not planned. You are burning the mosque or destroying the temples or killing a person. People get carried away by the mass minds. Religion is your unique experience. It has nothing to do with the mass minds. In the mass, you lose your identity. But you fall below. In religious experience also, you lose your identity, but you go above. Let this sentence be remembered by you. Religion is a pilgrimage, Sufis say, from unconscious anonymity to conscious anonymity. From unconscious anonymity. That's what happens in a crowd. You become anonymous. Unconscious. You lose your ego. But you fall below the ego. You become animalistic. That's why it is said that more crimes are done by crowds than by single individuals. Friedrich Nietzsche has said that madness in individuals is a rare phenomenon, but in crowds it is the general rule. It is very rarely people become mad. Individually. But it is almost the rule that crowds become mad. Just the general excitement is too much. The fire of it is too much. You start burning with it. And it is very unconscious. And because there is no more responsibility and there is no problem of conscience, you are not killing somebody, the crowd is killing. You are simply participating because you were there. Nobody can catch hold of you and nobody can say to you that you killed. Hindus killed, Mohammedans killed, communists killed. You were not individually responsible. In a mystical ceremony the same happens. It is an exploitation of the crowd mind. Beware of it. And about mystical experiences, three things have to be remembered. There are three kinds of spiritual experiences. One, pathological, neurotic, psychotic, hysterical. It happens many times that a hysterical person can become a Mahatma. Because he falls in hysteria, foams, goes into unconsciousness, utters gibberish. Do you know from where the word gibberish comes? It comes from a mystic named Jabir, because he used to utter nonsense. From Jabir has come the English word gibberish. He will utter such nonsense with no meaning. But it was thought that Jabir is a great mystic. He was simply hysterical. You can find such hysterical people in India being worshipped. They have to be treated. They are simply pathological. Sometimes it happens if you are pathological, hysterical, and in a mystical ceremony, you fall in a hysteria and people start thinking that you have gone into samadhi, ecstasy or something. And they start worshipping you. And when you come back and you see people touching your feet with flowers and garlands and sweets for you. Now you have found a trick. Now you can exploit your hysteria. And you will also start believing, because it is so nice to believe that you are becoming a spiritual person. Now their worship will help you to become more pathological. Rather than thinking that this is something wrong, you will think something great is happening to you. And one can go farther and farther into the mire. Remember, in the East there are many pathological people who are thought to be Mahatmas. And in the West, many real mystical people are put into mad asylums because they are thought to be pathological. Both attitudes are wrong. That's why I say this matter of spiritual experience is a delicate one. In the West, there are many mystical people who are in the hospitals being treated, given electric shocks, insulin shocks, because it is thought that they are hysterical. Just think, if Ramakrishna was born in America, he would be in some mad asylum. Because his mystical experience was from the outside almost like hysteria. Falling unconscious, his body will become stiff, his mouth will start foaming, his eyes will go up. This is all what happens in hysteria. It is a fit. This matter is delicate. If Ramakrishna was in the West, he would have been treated. And they have devised such strong methods to treat people that there is every possibility they would have made Ramakrishna normal. But that would have been a great misfortune. In the East, just the reverse is happening. I have come across many people. Sometimes they have been brought to me with the idea that I will recognize their state. But I said, they are just hysterical people. Just hysteria and nothing else. They are neurotic. They need some therapy. They have fallen below the normal. But to fall below the normal or to go above the normal sometimes looks alike. Only a master can be decisive about it. Otherwise it is very difficult to decide what is what. But there are few things which can be given to you as indications. If it is pathological, the person will become more and more sad, dull, lustless. If it is pathological, the person will become more and more tense, anxious, worried. If it is pathological, the person will become less and less attentive, will lose presence of mind, will become uncreative. If it is pathological, the person's body will start suffering in many ways. The person will not be of any creative value to the society if it is pathological. If it is not pathological, the person will have more life, more aliveness, more love, more compassion, more intelligence, more presence of the mind. The person will have a glow. He will be drunk with the divine, but his drunkenness will have a kind of awareness in it. Utterly drunk and yet utterly aware, that's how he will be. And he will be creative. His being here on the earth will be beneficial to people. So the first thing is pathological. The second thing is fakes. There are fakes who can perform. Seeing that it pays well, you can become a performer. You can pretend that something is happening to you. If you see that people come and touch your feet, and people think that you have arrived, why not pretend? It is good business. You can start pretending. Remember, mind is so cunning, it can go on being cunning in every possible way. And the third is the real. And one more complexity. Sometimes, if the real is not under the right guidance, he can fall and become pathological. And if the pathological is under right guidance, sometimes it happens that the pathological can become real. So more complexity is there. Sometimes it happens the fake can become pathological. Pretending he started, but by and by he got into it. Something erupted in him, some energy source ruptured in him, and he became pathological. He had started on his own, deliberately, but one day he found that it is no more deliberate. It is beyond his control. And sometimes it can also happen that under the right guidance, the fake can become the real. Because the fake, if made aware what he is doing, and if he is really in search and has chosen just a cheap way of performance under the guidance of the right master, he may drop his pseudoness and start moving towards the real. And the last thing, remember, the real can sometimes become fake. Because the spiritual experience is such that it happens when it happens. For example, one day it happens, and suddenly you are in it, completely gone and lost, utterly blissful. Then people start gathering around you. Then people start gathering to see the mystical experience. Then one day they are there, and it is not happening. And now your whole prestige is at stake. You can pretend, you can become fake. So complexity becomes double or triple. Right guidance is needed. Otherwise, you can fall into any trap of the mind. One day a disciple who was both incapable of learning and regularly driven abnormal by attending mystical ceremonies visited him. He asked, "How can I best profit from the teachings of the sages?" Now look at the question, how can I best profit? The idea is of profit, greed. The idea is to accumulate. The idea is to become more powerful. The idea is not to dissolve, to disappear. How can I best profit from the teachings of the sages? And the misunderstanding is there. Because sages have no teachings. Sages have messages, but no teachings. Advices, but no teachings. Sages open the door to the unknown, but don't supply you with any theories, philosophies, ideologies. The Sufi said, "I am happy to be able to tell you that I have an infallible method which corresponds to your capacity." And the man must have been very happy. And he asked, "And what is that, if I am allowed to hear it?" simply stop up your ears and think about the radishes. Now you will be surprised about this method. Is the sage joking? Making the man look foolish, ridiculing? No. The sage cannot do that. It is impossible in a state of compassion. No, he is exactly giving him a method. It looks absurd. Simply stop up your ears and think about radishes, but it is exactly what Maharishi Mahesh Yogi is giving to the West. It is a transcendental meditation. Close your ears and think of radishes. Anything can become a mantra. That's why I say there is no need to repeat Om. There is no need to repeat Allah. You can repeat even Coca-Cola. That will do. And more so because now Coca-Cola has disappeared from India. There will be more desire for Coca-Cola than for Om. And who bothers about Allah when Coke is missing? Even you can repeat your own name, and that will do. The great poet Tennyson has written in his memoirs that when he was a child, sometimes the parents will not be at home and he will feel so afraid that not finding what to do, so alone, he will simply repeat his own name, Tennyson, 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 just to give him a feeling as if somebody is there, as if mother is calling him Tennyson or the father is there. Just he will call his own name, not finding anything else, and he was so afraid, but that will help him and soothe him and he will fall asleep. So he found a transcendental meditation. And by and by, he entered into it. And that became his meditation for his whole life. So whenever he will find any anxiety, any trouble arising, some fear, he will repeat his name a few times and everything will cool down. Or whenever he will find that sleep is not coming, he will repeat his name and sleep will come. Yes, it is possible, because Allah or Tennyson or any word will do. The question is, if you repeat it, if you only think of it, all other thinking disappears, you become focused. In that focusing, you become silent. But this is the lowest kind of meditation. The sage is not ridiculing. He is not laughing at the man. He says, I am happy to be able to tell you that I have an infallible method which corresponds to your capacity. He is saying that this is where you are. More than that won't do. This will be enough for you. You are very childish, juvenile. Just repeating a name or thinking of something will do. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's meditation is very juvenile. It is very childish. It is for the beginners. Yes, it gives a kind of consolation. It helps to soothe you. It is just like a tranquilizer. And for people who are in search for anything, and in a very, very juvenile way, particularly America, is in great search for something to hang to. Because all that is available has become meaningless. Money, power, all has become meaningless. It is there. For the first time, a society has become affluent. All is there, so there is no hope in it. One is finished with it. Everybody is asking, what else? What now? So people are searching. And when people search, and there is no long tradition, no long continuity of the search, and America is one of the most childish societies too, because only 300 years it has existed on the earth. It has no past to refer to, no past to have a context, no silsila, what Sufis call, no continuity of his spirituality. It is the first urge. So America is a kind of kindergarten land as far as its spirituality is concerned. So any person can go and any person can become a guru. It is so easy to become a guru in America. And people are searching anything, harmful, meaningful, meaningless, anything. There are two gurus, the greatest gurus in America, Maharishi Hasis Yogi and Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. People are trying even Hasis to attain to God. There is no sense of direction. This man must have been childish, juvenile. He had been to many mystical ceremonies and many mystical teachers, and he has been going from one school to another and collecting few information from here, few from there, and creating a garbage inside his mind. When the sage said that you simply stop up your ears and think about radishes, he is not joking. He is exactly saying what corresponds to his capacity. More than that will not be applicable right now. More than that will be dangerous. He has to be started with. You have to break him into the world of spirituality from the point where he is. In America, every kind of thing goes. For the simple reason, because people are in search and people don't have any direction and they don't have any reference with the past. Their parents have never searched spirituality. Their parents were in search of money. Their parents were in search of money and they succeeded. And in that very success, everything failed. Their parents have only one thing that was enough to keep them drunk, and that was power. How to have a big house, how to have a big car, how to have more money, more power. They were drunk with power. And they had only one thing as their religion, and that was work. Work is American ethos. Work hard, so that you can achieve many things in the world. And they succeeded, unfortunately. They succeeded. And their children are at a loss. Now what? Money is there, house is there, car is there, everything is there. Now they don't make any sense just to rush after them. When they are there, why rush for them? They are already available. Something else is needed. Anything will do. Sex will do. Psychedelics will do. Yoga will do. Tantra will do. Anything will do. And any pretender can become a guru. Listen to this. A gray-haired lady climbed 3 flights of stairs, opened a carved mahogany door, and walked into an exotically furnished reception room. A gong sounded, and out of a cloud of incense appeared a beautiful brunette oriental. "Do you?" she said softly, wish to meet with his omnipotence, the wise, all-knowing, all-seeing Guru, Maharishi Naru. Eh, said the elderly woman, tell Arvind, his mama is here from the Bronx. It is happening. It is happening for a certain reason. People are in search and they don't know what they are searching. Any pretender can promise rose gardens, can promise paradise, and the promise will do. And Americans know how to promise, they know how to advertise. They know how to persuade people to purchase anything. About that, they are one of the most skilled people. So now God has become the commodity. But unless you rise in your capacity to learn, you rise in your capacity to seek and search, you can call that your search is for truth, but it will remain for something else. This man was simply stupid, mediocre, unintelligent. He was wasting his time and others' time, but he was collecting information from here and there, and he was enjoying the ego that feels that I am becoming knowledgeable. Now it was by chance, fortunately, that he stumbled to the door of this sage. The sage says, simply stop up your ears and think about radishes. Before, during or after the lectures and exercises, ask the man, instead of attending any of them. I am reminded of a woman who went to her doctor. The doctor was very much troubled by the woman. Every year she will give birth to a child. She had already 12, and now the 13th was coming. And the doctor said, enough is enough. Now you stop. The woman said, now I am also thinking, it is becoming tiring. I am exhausted. Would you suggest me something that can prevent me from becoming pregnant? The doctor said, yes. Drink a cup of hot water. The woman said, before or after? The doctor said, instead. The master said, instead. Neither before, during or after the lectures and exercises. You drop all those exercises. They are stupid. And you drop all those lectures. They are meaningless. The first thing that you have to do is to become a little more collected, calm. It will be the best thing. You close your ears. You have already allowed your ears to take too much which you cannot carry. You are already burdened. So close your ears is simply symbolic. Symbolic, then don't gather any more information. It is already too much. It is driving you mad. Close your ears means no need to know about truth. To know about truth is not to know truth. So drop this round and round going in circles, about and about. Close your ears. And of course, he says that just think of radishes. Maybe the man has only that much capacity. I have heard a Hindu parable. A man came to a sage and asked what he should do. He was a simple man. The sage asked, do you love somebody? The man said, no. I am a poor man. And you see, I am ugly too. So no woman ever agreed to marry. So I am unmarried. I am a bachelor. Nobody loves me. The sage says, then it will be a little difficult. Still you think Nobody loves you, that's okay, but you love somebody, anything will do, a tree, a dog, anything. The man said, I love my buffalo. The faith says that will do. You just go home and meditate on your buffalo. See God in the form of buffalo. Look at the buffalo and feel the divine. Because wherever your love is, from that point exactly one has to proceed. Let buffalo be the first point of your journey, the departure point. The arrival has always to be God, but the departures will differ. Somebody loves nature, then that is the beginning of his meditation. Somebody loves music, then that is the beginning of his meditation. There are people who have no musical ears. If you tell them, make music your meditation, that will be impossible. That will become a barrier. They will never arrive to God. There are people who are completely dead about nature. Nature has no appeal for them. These immense colors all around, this green and red, and the leaves and the foliage and the flowers, don't make any sense to them. They have not seen them. They have no eye for it. They are blind as far as beauty is concerned. Then this cannot be their door to the divine. The advice is very practical. You have to start from where you are. There is no other way to start. And everybody has to start in his own way. And as you grow, better meditations will be given to you. Meditations has to be given according to your capacity. You start growing, meditations higher, deeper will be given to you. And the final stage is when you have really grown up, all meditations will be taken away from you. The final stage of meditation is the disappearance of meditation. When meditation has become perfect, you have to drop it. At that moment, to cling to the meditation will be the last barrier. You have to drop that too. Meditation has to become one day so natural, like breathing, that you need not do it. It is always there. It is a kind of presence around you, within, without. Asleep, you are meditative. Walking, you are meditative. Talking, you are meditative. Doing this and that, and you are meditative. Your meditation never leaves you. It has become your shadow. Then, a man has really become a meditator. Remember this paradox. When meditation is arrived, it has to be dropped. And one has to begin as one's capacity allows. The master said, first thing is to stop hearing more about truth. You have already heard much. The after dinner speaker was boring and long-winded. One after another, the guests nodded off to sleep at their places. The exasperated and embarrassed master of ceremonies frantically banged his gavels. In his wild banging, he hit the snoring man next to him on the head. "Hit me again," said the snorer. "I can still hear the son of a bitch." The master says, "You have heard enough. You have read enough. You already know more than you need. You close your ears. And your capacity is so low that whatsoever you have heard, you will go on misinterpreting. It will be never relevant. It will be always irrelevant. Because your being is very low and your knowledge is very high. They don't meet. Your being will interpret. Your knowledge will be interpreted by your being. And it will be always a corruption. It will always be irrelevant and out of context. Maybe the man who was saying it had a context for it. Or the book you read it in had a context for it. But in you, it will simply become a fragment, floating, unrelated to you, unrooted in you. It will be burden. It will not enlighten you. It will burden you more. It will not unburden you. A man and his wife were standing in front of the gorilla cage at the zoo. Suddenly the gorilla reached through the bars and pulled the woman into his cage and started to rip off her clothes. She screamed, "Herman, what do I do now?" Herman shrugged his shoulders and replied, "Tell him you have a headache, dear." One thing may be relevant in one context. It is not relevant in all contexts. But the context comes from your being. So never know more than you are. Be more, know less, and you will always be moving in the right direction. Know a little, but do it. Absorb it. Digest it. Otherwise, knowledge can become a kind of indigestion. It can create nausea. You will have to vomit it. Eat little, but let it be digested so it becomes blood, bones, and marrow. Sufis are very practical people, very down to earth. The sage must have looked in the man. His capacity is very poor. If he has to be helped, he has to start from there. It is not insulting. The sage is not ridiculing. It is out of his compassion that he says you do two things. One is you stop gathering knowledge no more. In fact, you unlearn all that you have learned. Close your ears and think of something that you like. Think of something that you love. Think of something with which you can fall enraptured. Whatever it is, that will be the first glimpse of God into your being. And the journey starts from there. Enough for today.